This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We put the spotlight on peacemakers throughout history and today, whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations. We consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. So why is it such a challenge to keep peace in our families and workplaces? Why are people so reactive to one another? Why can't we just get along? As Rodney King wondered during the 1992 LA riots. On today's Peace Talks Radio, we'll explore the field of social intelligence, or a person's ability to understand his or her environment well enough to react consciously to promote peaceful outcomes. We'll talk with two authors who will explain the brain's role in social intelligence and how we might be able to manage our brains to be more peaceful in social interactions. Later in the program, our Suzanne Kreider will speak with Dr. Rick Hansen, a neuropsychologist in San Rafael, California, and co-author of the book Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. But first, we'll hear Suzanne's conversation with Dr. Daniel Goleman, an author, psychologist, and science journalist. For 12 years, he wrote for the New York Times, specializing in psychology and brain sciences. Goleman authored the two best-selling books, Emotional Intelligence and Social Intelligence, and in 2009, Ecological Intelligence, How Knowing the Hidden Impacts of What We Buy Can Change Everything. Suzanne Kreider started her chat with Daniel Goleman like this.
Hey, what is it about the brain that prevents people from getting along better than we do?
Well, you know, our brain is wired for a different reality than we live in today. The human brain was shaped over about 80,000 generations in evolution when we mostly lived on savannas and we were dealing with real life, urgent, dire threats, snarling tigers, dangerous rustles in the woods that warned us something was happening. And so we're attuned to a range of dangers that we don't face. Instead, we face symbolic dangers. This is one of the complications. The other complication is that the brain's radar for danger and threat, which is centered mostly in the structure called the amygdala, this scans for threats at every moment, even today, even though, you know, this was needed in evolution tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago, we're still scanning for threat. And the amygdala wants to know, am I safe? Is it dangerous? And the brain is wired so that if the amygdala thinks there's a danger, it can hijack the rest of the brain in a second. And not only that, the amygdala has a special privileged position in the brain where it gets sensory inputs from what we hear, from what we see in a single neuron. The neocortex, the thinking part of the brain, takes much longer to get the message. So the amygdala is able to use a kind of hair trigger mechanism when it thinks there's a danger to take us over before we have the full rational understanding of what's going on. So you put that all together. Oh, there's another problem. Only about 5% or less of the signal from the senses actually goes to the amygdala. The rest goes to other parts of the brain. So it's looking at what amounts to a fuzzy image. So we have this hair trigger mechanism that's looking at a fuzzy image and trying to guess if we're safe, and that can hijack the brain if it thinks there's danger here. And then it's looking at symbolic threats. It's not, is it a tiger? It's, am I being treated fairly or unfairly? So the result is that the brain's danger circuitry can hijack us in a split second before we rationally know what's going on.
And that symbolic danger is, for example, if somebody steps in front of you in the line at the post office, it's like you're being attacked, but really nothing's wrong.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that the danger, the threat can be something like someone else took credit for my work or, you know, honey, we have to talk, or any of those kinds of messages that we get that we might take as a potential threat. But in fact, biologically, they're no threat at all. And yet we respond with the same surge of stress hormones and shifts of blood to our limbs so we can run and or fight. So we respond with kind of an overkill to threats in today's life.
And what can people do? What can our listeners do to mediate that overkill that you talk about, when we're more reactive than we really need to be?
Well, one thing you or any of us can do is remind ourselves that our first urge to get angry or to be really fearful is probably coming from the amygdala, and we need to give the rest of our brain time to catch up. So just taking a pause, a kind of a mindful pause before we respond is essential. I remember going to a classroom in New Haven, Connecticut. On the wall of every room, there's a poster. It's a stoplight, red light, yellow light, green light. And it says, when you're getting upset, remember the stoplight. Red light, stop, calm down, and think before you act. That's the critical piece, to realize that our emotions come to us unbidden. We don't expect them. We don't ask for them. They come from an unconscious part of the brain. But once we feel a certain way, we have a choice point, which is how we respond. Yellow light, think of a range of different things you could do. Green light, pick the best one and try it out. Well, you know, kids in the schools are taught to use it from kindergarten on, but I think it's good advice for any of us.
Mm-hmm. Dan, tell us about social-emotional learning programs for children. What are those?
Well, it's something I've been advocating since I wrote the book Emotional Intelligence. That book really is an argument for making sure that every child gets lessons in self-awareness and handling their rocky emotions and empathizing in social skill in childhood, making sure that they get it as part of their school lessons. It turns out that social-emotional learning programs fit quite seamlessly into the school day, don't take much time for academic topics, but add something really rich for kids, which is teaching them how to manage themselves, how to manage their emotional world, how to handle relationships, how to get along with other kids, how to have a happy life. And I think there's nothing more important. The big news is that a major study, it's called a meta-analysis. It aggregates, puts together, this one, more than 200 separate studies of schools where kids had these programs and where they didn't. It found that every positive kind of behavior, liking school, behaving in class, not cutting class, goes up about 10% and far more in the schools that need it the most. Every negative behavior, fights, violence, disruptive behavior in class, goes down by the same margin, again, most in the schools that need it the most. And academic achievement scores go up by 11%. Why? Because when a child is preoccupied by fear, anger, jealousy, whatever it is, they can't pay attention. Helping children manage their disruptive emotions means that they can pay full attention to what it is they're supposed to learn. So it's a win-win-win for the schools and for children and for our communities.
Wouldn't critics say, gee, that's what parents are supposed to teach kids?
Of course it is, and parents, most parents do. But remember, not every child has a situation at home where they get the kind of parenting they need. And even if your family is very good at it, think about it. Your children will go through life with every other child, and you want to be sure that the people that they're going to share their life with, who are going to be in the community, also have these lessons.
Dan Goleman, let's talk about a parent's impact on how well their children get along with other people and how well they can get along with people as adults. Because there's been research where children who are abused misinterpret facial signals. They don't have spot-on empathy because they never learned it, what, from their parents, from the mirror neuron process of watching their parents?
Well, we can't say why it's so, but studies of bullies in schools show that they have a perceptual skew. They tend to experience neutral faces as negative ones. And one of the theories is that their parents may be very harsh, very judgmental. We can't say for sure, but we do know, and this is good news, that if those bullies in elementary school are shown two things, how to read emotions accurately and how to get along well with other kids, they stop being bullies, and I think that's very good news.
Hmm.
Stephen Nowicki at Emory University in Atlanta had he had an after-school club for bullies. He didn't call it the Bullies Club, of course. He had schools identify bullies in elementary years, and he paired each bully with a nice kid and taught them how to get along, how to take turns, how to be patient, how to ask about the other kid, and also how to read facial expressions accurately. And after about, I think it was maybe an 8-week, 10-week program, those kids had stopped being bullies.
We need to do that in the workplace.
Wherever it is, those in authority need to get everyone to condemn it, not to stand by. Being silent in that situation, doing nothing, is to be complicit with a bully. It's very important to set an explicit norm that this is not acceptable here.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners who are parents, Dan Goleman, what are some behaviors you recommend they do with their children so that their children can learn how to get along with people better?
Well, you know, parents are really a child's first mentor in how to manage emotions. And I think parents do this kind of teaching in the course of the day, very naturally. Anytime, for example, you help a young child understand that, you know, when you did that to your friend and she started crying, it was because, you know, you were mean to her and she felt. In other words, if you explain to a child, a young child, how their actions are experienced by another person, you're giving a lesson in empathy. Every time a child has a tantrum and you help that child calm down, you're actually teaching that child emotional mastery, how to calm down herself. Every time a child has some melodrama with playmates, you know, they won't play with me, and you help her to think of something you could do that you all enjoy, you're enhancing her social intelligence, her ability to sense how to get along better with other people. So I think it's not something that parents need to stretch to do. I think it's something that parents need to realize is very beneficial and important to keep doing.
Dan Goleman, how does empathy work in the brain?
Well, it depends what you mean by empathy. You know, there are really three kinds of empathy. One is cognitive empathy, which is understanding how the other person thinks about things, seeing things from their perspective. And that involves neocortical, top of the brain circuitry. The second kind is emotional empathy. And this is an immediate felt sense of what the other person is feeling. And this most likely involves a newly discovered set of brain cells. They're called mirror neurons. The way they were discovered is very telling. A lab in Italy was studying motor cortex of monkeys. They did it by recording one cell at a time in a monkey's brain. And one day they were watching a cell that only fired when the monkey raised its arm. It didn't do anything otherwise. And one afternoon it started firing and the monkey wasn't moving. They were completely perplexed. Then they realized what was going on. A lab assistant had gone out to get a gelato. It was a hot day. And he was back in the lab. He was standing in front of the cage. Every time he took a lick, the monkey's neuron for doing the same thing triggered. And it turns out our brains are peppered with mirror neurons, and they are especially powerful in responding to the emotions we sense in someone else, the movements they're making, even their intentions. So I suspect that emotional empathy must involve the mirror neurons. And then the third is empathic concern, which means we not only understand how the other person thinks and how they're feeling, but if they're in need, we are spontaneously ready to help them if we can.
Is empathic concern, Dan, what you experienced? You tell the story in your book, Social Intelligence, about seeing a man lying in the subway.
Well, this was when I was working at the New York Times, and I had just done an article on homeless people. This was the 80s, and there was all of a sudden homelessness prevalent all over Manhattan. It was a pretty new phenomenon at that scale. And it was Friday afternoon, end of the day, and everybody's going down to the subway in Times Square to go home. People are streaming down the stairs. And as I'm walking down, halfway down the stairs, I encounter a guy who's just slumped over. He has no shirt, not moving. And people are just stepping over him. And I was so shocked and kind of tuned in to, hey, what's going on with this guy, that I stopped to see what was happening. The minute I stopped, six other people stopped. Very interesting. And we discovered that this fellow had no money. He hadn't eaten in days. He'd fainted from hunger. He only spoke Spanish. Within minutes, someone went to get him a hot dog. Someone went to get him orange juice. Someone brought a Subway cop. And, you know, he was back on his feet. But it took that moment of noticing. And you have to realize that there's a spectrum of attention that runs from utter self-absorption on the one hand. You know, we've got our own worries, preoccupations, to-do list, hopes, dreams, whatever, and we're lost in our own mind and we walk by and don't see a soul, to tuning in, being a little mindful, paying attention to what's going on. The phrase the urban trance has been used by sociologists to describe the way in which we protect ourselves from sensory overload by kind of creating a perceptual shell and tuning in to only what's salient. So there's a balance between not being overwhelmed by taking in everything and not being able to understand anything and not tuning out of what's most important. What really matters.
Psychologist and author Daniel Goleman, who supplied us with a number of useful links to his work and others in the field of social and emotional intelligence. You can find all those at our website, peacetalksradio.com. I'm Paul Ingles, and to continue our program today on the neuroscience of getting along, we turn to Dr. Rick Hansen, a neuropsychologist from San Rafael, California, who received a Ph.D. in clinical psychology from the Wright Institute in 1991 and has written several books, including Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's a co-founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Here again is our Suzanne Kreider, who picks up on the idea of sensory overload that Daniel Goleman was talking about in her conversation with Rick Hansen.
Rick, in your book, Buddha's Brain, you write about how you're concerned about modern life and that it leads to a pretty consistent arousal of the sympathetic nervous system. It's sort of that adrenalized feeling. What impact does that have on people getting along with each other?
It's a problem because while there's absolutely a place for positive activations, I think about how excited I got when our daughter, who was about 10 years old at the time, finally took a shot in basketball in the YMCA league she was playing in. I was so happy. There's completely a place for that. On the other hand, because of the negativity bias in the brain, if you will, when we get activated, in other words, when we get excited or aroused or rushed, I mean, much of modern life is about rushing about. As soon as we're rushing about, we're getting activation of the sympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system. It's the fight or flight stress response wing. And it has its wholesome purposes. But as soon as you start activating that wing, you start warming up the circuits of fighting or fleeing. In other words, you start activating the system that is primed to go negative. So suddenly it's on a yellow flag condition. Yes, you can do a lot of good things under a yellow flag, but it's really helpful to appreciate the fact that you're under a yellow flag. That means that if we're stressed or revved up or preoccupied or rushing about, we're much more likely to be irritable. We're much more likely to take offense. We're much more likely to feel threatened when something was actually really trivial. We're much more likely to take things personally because rushing about activates the sense of self. You know, me, myself, and I, dealing with the world, you know, kind of outnumbered, beleaguered, but I got to get these emails done now, right? And as soon as we go into that mode, it's a lot more difficult to stay present, to be relaxed, to be connected, to see clearly what's happening with the other person, and so forth. So one thing I've really come to do out of all this is I kind of feel I've got a little needle. I've got an internal stress meter, and I'm just watching that needle a fair amount of the time. I'm not perfect by any means, but I'm just kind of tracking it. And when I start getting revved up, I'll deliberately take some long exhalations or do other kinds of things that activate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system and calm that sympathetic fight-flight response down.
You mentioned taking a long exhalation. What are some other tips to slow that sympathetic nervous system down?
One is, as I said earlier, taking in the good and really focusing on positive emotion. In other words, if we're mildly happy, if we find ways to be grateful, glad, moments of contentment, appreciation, recognition of the good amidst the difficulties in the world. I don't mean ignoring what's not good. I mean seeing the world clearly. And the world as a whole is a big mosaic. It's got a lot of good, it's got some bad, and it's got a lot that's neutral. Most of us tend to not particularly dwell on what's actually really good in daily situations in particular. So looking at that and also using that as a way in for positive emotion. It doesn't mean that we're not sad sometimes or depressed sometimes or worried sometimes. As we get, you know, further along in terms of just kind of becoming in touch with ourselves and growing, increasingly it feels like our well-being starts expanding. You know, maybe it starts out as like a little puddle on the street. And, you know, if you dump a cup of salt, let's say, into a puddle, to use my metaphor, and drink from the puddle, it's going to be really yucky. But if you know, your sense of well-being gets larger and larger, becomes a pond, and then actually becomes a lake, you dump a cup of salt into that lake, let's say feeling angry or stressed or anxious, etc., and then drink the water from that lake, that salt is going to be held in a much larger context. And that's what people talk about. Their well-being becomes increasingly unconditional and spacious, and it includes sad feelings and angry feelings and all the rest, but they're much smaller relative to the whole. So that's the second thing. Really focus on positive emotions. The third thing is to activate this parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, which dials down the sympathetic fight or flight wing. I named a suggestion already, which is long exhalations. Another great method is to relax the tongue. Parasympathetic system's very involved in the mouth. It's the rest and digest system in balance to the fight or flight system. That's another way too. And then the last one, I think, which goes to what we've talked about earlier in terms of evolution and the ways we're very, very threat reactive, is to really focus on a sense of safety. In other words, not perfect safety, but feeling as safe as you reasonably can. Most of us do not feel as safe as we reasonably can. We feel more alarmed, threatened, beleaguered, overwhelmed, and unsafe than we logically, reasonably need to feel. And the result is a lot of needless suffering as well as a lot of needless reactivity to others. Because when we're primed by our own feelings of not being safe, we're much more likely to take offense or lash out or overreact to situations. So, for example, I'll do little things like just remind myself that I'm okay, that this is a passing event, that I'm strong, that I don't have to agree. And minimally, even if I'm stuck in a yucky situation, I can do things inside my head. And then, honestly, I'll admit some of my own personal methods as a sci-fi kind of guy as a kid. I just can hear Captain Kirk's voice in the back of my head. Shields up, Scotty. And I'll just imagine some kind of shield going up, if you will, between me and another person that I can see what's happening out there, but nothing's coming in to harm the core of my being.
Humans have this unusual ability in the mammal world. It's called theory of mind. Explain that and what the impact is on relating, getting along with people.
Sure. It's the idea that people develop sort of a theory or a notion of what in the world is going on inside the head of other people. What are their thoughts? What are their desires? What are their values? What are their intentions? What are their hopes? What are their dreams? What are their nefarious plans towards you? Whatever it is, that's theory of mind. The wonderful news, of course, is that as humans, we've evolved these fundamental capacities to plan cooperatively, to tune into each other, to be loving and caring.
But it seems like the amygdala's natural tendency to be negative and judgmental gets in the way of people creating a theory of mind. Isn't that the problem, that when we're interacting with people and we're upset with them, we stay focused on ourselves rather than being curious about what's going on for them?
I think that's true in some ways, but the thing to appreciate is that these capacities are neutral in a sense that just like you can use a hammer to build a house or to bonk somebody on the head. So it's not enough to deploy, if you will, these empathic capacities. We have to use them well. In other words, we have to, for example, use those theory of mind capacities to recognize the fact that running in the mind of the other person who, let's say, yes, did mistreat us in some way, also running in their mind were all kinds of other things. interpretations of what we did, underlying hurts from the last two or three times we interacted, the ways that they're already having a bad day, you know, based on their worries about their child or the guy who, you know, was cut them off on the freeway on the way to work, whatever it is, you know, looking past the surface. Well, I talk about, you know, seeing the being behind the eyes and looking past the eyes to the internal being, particularly the softer, more vulnerable, and sometimes younger layers in the other person. For example, typically there's hurt and fear underneath anger. So if someone's treating you badly, a really effective thing to do is to pause, have compassion for yourself, get on your own side, and then try to look clearly at what in the world is going on here. Because you've paused, you buy yourself the time to do it if you possibly can. And in so doing, really try to sense into what is the hurt in that other person? What is their suffering? What are their fundamentally positive aims that they're pursuing in problematic ways? And then based on that, naturally what's evoked is compassion. And then based on compassion, you're not as likely to react so badly. You're going to feel better. It's not like you're rolling over and being a doormat. Paradoxically, seeing the other person suffering clearly and having compassion for them, A, makes you feel better, and B, helps you act a lot more skillfully on your own behalf.
Talk about the action step. What are some communication tips that you recommend to people when they want to get along? They want to be empathic, but they're dealing with their own reactive amygdala. What's a good thing to say?
To appreciate the way that we often overreact, that the truth is there isn't really a threat, or it's a tiny threat instead of a big threat, or it's a delayed threat, or it's a threat that came and went, or it's a threat, in other words, a challenge, a difficult situation, a problem, what have you, that one fully has the resources to deal with. That's A. The other thing is to appreciate the ways that very often we needlessly give other people cause to fear us. And there's a traditional saying, you know, I have a background as a meditation teacher, and there's a traditional saying, give no one cause to fear you. And I have become a lot more thoughtful about needlessly doing things that trigger other people, just little things like eye rolls, you know, playing superior, being a little snippy, being too fast, being too penetrating, taking power in a way that's not actually really shared. Those are all kinds of ways a person can be thoughtful about not needlessly triggering the other person. I think there's a place for saying what needs to be said. And paradoxically, the more you're able to settle into a place of peace inside yourself, so you're at peace with yourself and you feel at peace in your own body and you're at peace with the other person, paradoxically, that enables you to be stronger than ever. I've given a lot of thought to the integration of compassion and assertiveness, because either alone is not enough, but it's the weaving of the two together, the synergy of the two together, that's what this world needs today. The key point here really is, are we going to be passive and just swept along by these ancient evolutionary currents that drive us toward emotional reactivity, a negativity bias, and fearful aggression toward them, you know, involving the snarling wolf of hate? Or will we also alternately use the human capacities for love, for reflection, for learning, for self-direction, and for virtue and morality and unilateral virtue? Will we draw on those instead? And to me, that's the critical choice.
That's Dr. Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain and co-founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom in San Rafael, California. You can find links to the work of both of our guests, Rick Hansen and Daniel Goleman, at our website, peacetalksradio.com. You can also hear an hour-long version of this program, as well as find links to our complete interviews with both guests there. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear all the programs in our series, order CDs, sign up for a free podcast or our newsletter, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program, all at peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, AMP Concerts, Albuquerque's roving concert series at ampconcerts.org, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. I'm Paul Ingles. Thank you for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.